from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, what's going to happen to prop up California's unemployment insurance fund, which is running out of money? Also, why some fish in a key drinking water supply are stunted and deformed? And the state of flamenco as organizers prepare for a big performance event later this week in Sacramento. But first, for three decades, there's been little or no official government-level communication between the U.S. and Iran. But relations might be thawing at the university and research level. Recently, a group of U.S. university officials toured Iran and visited universities and met Iran's Minister of Science, Research and Technology. One of the people on that trip was the Chancellor of UC Davis, Larry Vanderhoof. Larry, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
What are the prospects for U.S. universities and researchers to work more closely with their counterparts in Iran?
Well, if it was just up to the universities, I think the prospects would be very, very good, because universities, although we talk about our complexity somehow, are really quite simple. We teach and we do research and we try to get the products of that research out into the public. So based on that, we talk well to each other. We talk the same language, and we had great meetings with university people. But, of course, between our two countries, there's another element, and that's the governmental element. And the first trip, back in 2004, I was very confident that everything was going to go fine. This time around, maybe not quite so confident.
I see. Are the researchers and universities in Iran as interested in working with you and your colleagues as you and your colleagues are interested in working with them?
Yeah, without a doubt. We have to remember that prior to the revolution in 1979, we had more people coming to this country for education from Iran than from any other country in the world. So we have, in Iran, we have lots and lots of alumni. That is to say, this country has lots and lots of alumni, and they have great experiences in the U.S., and they want to continue that, and they want, in fact, their children to be able to have the same experiences.
You mentioned there the previous trip that you were on to Iran with university officials from the United States. That was in 2004, but you sensed something different. Describe to us in some more detail what was different this time.
Yeah, I can describe the differences. I can't tell you exactly why things were different. In 2004, that was largely, in fact, Momo Hanna was very important in establishing that, and Iravani, Ayatollah Iravani, and people, it was much more at on the ground level, even though we were the first official university delegation to go there. It was much more on the ground, people to people. This time, we had six presidents of major universities in the country, and I felt like this time around there was more temptation on the part of some people in Iran to get a little bit political.
I see. Well, you mentioned Mo Mohanna, and he is in our studio. Mo Mohanna, the Sacramento property owner and developer and philanthropist. He's a trustee of the UC Davis Foundation, and he's also hosting a Persian dinner tomorrow evening in Sacramento, where Larry Vanderhoof will discuss his recent trip to Iran. Mo, welcome back to Insight.
Very good, Jeff. I'm glad to be here. And the dinner is tonight, by the way.
I'm so sorry. I misspoke. It is tonight.
You don't want to miss that wonderful Persian dinner, Jeff.
Indeed. Mo, do you know what's different? Why the mood might be a little different in Iran now at the university level than, say, a few years ago?
See, Jeff, Chancellor Vanderhoof will see the difference is different than I do, because I'm from Iran, I speak the languages, but the whole world is different from 2004. So there are differences in Iran, and simply because of the posture, I think, that America has taken towards Iran. As you know, we have been called Axis of Evil, and there has been no relationship between U.S. and Iran. I think what the chancellor is trying to do is build academic relationship, people-to-people relationship, and he's trying to turn nations into people so we can talk face-to-face in an academic level.
Do you think there's perhaps a national government-level influence on the universities in Iran more than there was a few years ago?
I wouldn't be able to say that because I did not go this time. I was busy engaged in local politics here, as you know. But Chancellor, I trust his judgment, and I'm sure there are difficulties.
Larry Vanderhoof, why Iran? Why have you and some of your colleagues at U.S. universities now gone to Iran twice in 4 years?
There are a couple of reasons. One of them is very practical. Iran is very much like California, and that's in terms of geography. And that's important to us because our agriculture is, so much of it is derived from Iran. Virtually all of our fruits and nuts and grapes came from that part of the world, and so we talk about English walnuts, but they really aren't. They're Persian walnuts, and all of those, everything in that general realm of fruits and nuts, so the climate, the geography, all of it is very similar. So we have lots to learn from Iran, and they have lots to learn from us, just because we're so much alike. So that's one reason. But and I'll just talk about one more reason. A second reason is that I have felt, and I continue to feel this way very strongly, that university to university, as I was saying before, we talk the same language. We have the same interests. I feel like this is the way, as Mo was saying, this is the way to crack the door, to get the conversations going, to get it at a non-political level. And I still feel very strongly that that's what can happen. And I think that's what they want to happen in Iranian universities, and that's what we want to happen here.
Mo Mohanna, what do people like you, people who are from Iran, now living in the United States, what do you hope can happen at the university, scientific, educational level? In terms of relations between the two countries?
Jeff, we are hoping that with the leadership of our chancellor, we could build bridges between universities in America and universities in Middle East. Chancellor already has gone to Tehran. They love him. He took his wife there. They really respect him. He went to Egypt with Qais Manufi, and that was a wonderful trip. So we want to do more of these things. So people of Middle East will receive UC Davis and other universities warmly. And then once we break bread, once we have relationship, then we can talk about our differences. There are more commonalities among people of Middle East and Muslims and Americans and Christians and Jews than you can think about. We are wonderful. We are all people of Abrahamic faith. We have a lot in common. Unfortunately, we have been talking about our differences, and we're talking about axis of evil and things that are really not practical. So at university level, we are hoping to talk about alliances between universities and building bridges and having academic dialogue rather than, other issues and conflicts that are not based on reason and logic.
Larry Vanderhoof, who's chancellor of UC Davis and recently visited Iran as part of a delegation of officials from U.S. universities, you met with colleagues at universities in Iran, but you also met Iran's Minister of Science, Research and Technology. That's a government official. What kind of conversation did you have with that person?
Well, he was quite intent on, first of all, talking about the ways in which we could interact together and the opportunities that we had. But he also took the opportunity to let us know that there were certain things that he felt really should change or could change. He was fretting about some of the United States activities.
Such as?
Well, one of them for sure was the fact that the United States always wants to talk about their uranium enrichment activities as being the first steps toward making weapons. They, of course, declare, and they've got nuclear power plants to show that what it's really for is for nuclear power.
Now, of course, you and your colleagues at other U.S. universities are in no position to affect U.S. policy in this matter.
Right.
So I guess, where did that conversation go then?
Well, I think we were the president's chancellor, same thing, of six major universities in the country. And I think the notion was that there would be a description of the trip by the president of the AAU. He's the one that was the organizer of this, or he helped organize it. And I think the notion was that if the presidents of six major universities came back with an attitude about things that were going on there, that it would make a difference. The AAU, you have to understand, is the major, we don't call it lobbying, but I mean they're the major influence on Congress in the country for higher education.
Yeah. Mo Mohanna, you mentioned earlier on the fact that Iran has been described as part of the axis of evil, that description was made by President Bush, who's going to be leaving office soon. Do you expect things will change between the U.S. and Iran when President-elect Obama takes office?
I really hope it does. I really hope it does. Or at least it gives the impression or the perceived impression that things will change.
Yes. Larry Vanderhoof, just one last question for you on an unrelated matter. You're going to be stepping down as Chancellor of UC Davis next summer after about 14 years in the job. What are you going to do after you step down?
Yeah, this will be my 15th year, and I have a couple of things on my mind. But one of the things certainly will be to continue these efforts with relationships between universities in our country and other countries. And to me, one of the places where I think the most good can come is in the Middle East.
Okay. Larry Vanderhoof, Chancellor of UC Davis. He's speaking at a Persian dinner this evening in Sacramento, talking about the recent trip to Iran, the delegation that he was part of to Iran, along with officials from other U.S. universities. Larry Vanderhoof, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Jeffrey.
And Mo Mohanis, since you're in our studio, if I may, without getting into the long history of K Street, where you have owned properties and there have been ongoing efforts over the years to redevelop K Street. You recently came to a deal with the city of Sacramento, and as I understand it, you no longer own some of the properties in the 700 and 800 blocks that you used to. How do you feel about whatever comes in the future on K Street without you being an active participant in it?
Jeff, since I live in Sacramento and I love Sacramento, I will always be involved in Sacramento. What we show the people of this community is that we can reconcile. We reconcile with our mayor, we reconcile with the city official, and we are moving forward. If we can reconcile locally, I'm sure we can reconcile internationally. I am a man of reconciliation. We can always leave our differences behind and work on positive things. These are challenging times in our economy. I'm very proud of what we accomplished with the old administration. We're working closely with Kevin Johnson and his new administration on revitalizing downtown. These are challenging times, but we are expert at reconciliation.
And what do you make of Mayor Johnson?
I think he's very positive. He is very enthusiastic. Berkeley kid. He's a good, sharp guy. We have some of his staff members coming over tonight for dinner to know that there is other world other than Sacramento. So I want them to get knowledgeable about Iran.
Some of his staff are going to this dinner this evening?
Yes.
I see. Well, that's the dinner which starts at 6 o'clock tonight. Can the public go?
Well, of course, we would like to have the public there, but we can only fit probably a couple of hundred people. So come on down. Persian hospitality is extended to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Mo Mohana. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Jeff, thank you very much. Pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. Coming up, what's going to happen to prop up California's unemployment insurance fund, which is running out of money, and why some fish in a key drinking water supply are deformed. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. An 8.0 earthquake is scheduled to destroy a bridge in Reno tomorrow, but don't worry, it's a simulated earthquake and a scale-size bridge. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll hear what researchers hope to learn from this. Also, around the world in 30 blocks, we start a tour of restaurants on Sacramento's Broadway. Plus, the Latin and klezmer-influenced jazz of Anat Cohen. California's unemployment insurance fund is quickly running out of money. The state says benefits will continue to be paid, but how can that happen given the rising rate of unemployment and California's chronic budget deficit? On the phone is Laurie Levy, who is Deputy Director of Public Affairs for California's Employment Development Department. Laurie, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
How would you describe the state of California's unemployment insurance fund right now?
Well, you know, right now we are paying out anywhere between $25 to $27 million a day in unemployment insurance benefits. And there's been just a huge increase, as I think we've all read about, in the demand for benefits, so much so that it's a 78% increase from the third quarter of 2007 to the third quarter of 2008. And what that is doing is it's just pretty much bringing us to a point within the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund where we expect to become insolvent sometime in January.
Was that 78% increase budgeted for or something budgeted for?
No, a 78% increase is just something that's occurred due to the nature of the economy, and we've been doing everything we can to keep up with that demand within our existing resources. And in addition to that, we've certainly been putting some plans in place to ensure that those benefits continue to be paid. And there's a couple of things on the table. Number one, we've already applied for a loan from the federal government to ensure those benefits continue to be paid. Of course, that's the most important thing. But then in the long term, there's the whole revenue generation model does need to be revised to be more reflective of today's economic demands. And the governor has put forth a proposal for that, and right now the legislature is considering that particular proposal.
Where does the money come from right now for the trust fund?
Well, right now employers pay unemployment pay contributions to pay for unemployment insurance benefits, and they pay that into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Unfortunately, that system, the revenue generation model, was set up back in 1984, and since that time, the minimum wage and the average weekly wage have more than doubled, so people are collecting even more in benefits. So there is a system by which the whole revenue generation model needs to be updated. But that's where the benefit money comes from, and with that fund running dry right now, we again will go to the federal government. There is a particular pot of money which employers do pay into through their federal unemployment tax, and that particular fund does pay for loans, the kind of loan that California is already requesting.
So is the department confident that the feds will extend this loan?
So again, the employers do pay through their unemployment, federal unemployment tax, into a pot of money that's reserved specifically for loans to states that face insolvency, much like California and many other states are right now. So we do anticipate we'll get that loan. The problem with that loan is if we're unable to pay it back by the end of September, we will owe interest to the federal government on that loan. And we do anticipate we will have difficulties paying back that loan, so we will probably owe the federal government about $20 million in interest at the end of September in 2009.
But there are enormous outlays at the federal level right now, great stresses on the federal budget with the $700 billion bailout for financial institutions that's been planned. There's talk about money for the car industry and so on. How sure can you be that the feds actually have the money to lend California?
Well, that's a good question because we've certainly all been hearing about a lot of budgetary difficulties. But the fortunate part here is that this is a separate fund. It is a fund specifically set aside for loans, and there is money in that fund right now so that states like California can get that loan and help us pay benefits. So we really don't have any doubt about that. We just have a doubt in terms of what are we going to do in the long run to ensure that this fund can remain solvent and that we won't face this problem in the future.
I'm talking with Laurie Levy, who's Deputy Director of Public Affairs for California's Employment Development Department. Specifically, we're talking about the fact that the state's unemployment insurance fund is running out of money and could be insolvent in January. Well, of course, this is a loan, so it needs to be paid back. But as I understand, Governor Schwarzenegger says that the deficit for this year is now looking to be $15 billion, much more than that in the next fiscal year. How can the state take on another obligation?
Good question. And like I mentioned, we do anticipate we will have difficulty paying back that federal loan and would owe about $20 million in interest at the end of next year. And even with that, we'll still be in a deficit situation. In fact, we anticipate being $2.4 billion in the hole at the end of next year. But that's why he's put forth this proposal to try to revise the whole revenue generation model so we won't get into this kind of insolvency situation in the future.
What would that be? What would that be, this changing the way that the fund is funded?
Well, what he's put forth is a proposal that kind of affects both sides of the equation, Jeffrey. It's affecting not only just the revenue generation aspect, but also the spending aspect. in his proposal is an additional contribution from employers that would take effect in 2010 if the legislature chooses to adopt this proposal. Also, on the spending side, he's put forth some recommendations that would impact about a third of claimants, that they would see a slight reduction in the amount of benefits they could collect in unemployment insurance.
So he's talking about, in part, more money from employers, but this has to go through the legislature, and Republicans have made it very clear repeatedly that they are not interested in adding any, in taking more money out of employers or pretty much anyone else to balance the budget.
Difficult situation, and in fact, I mean, the proposal does call for this to take effect sometime in 2010. The good news here is that it allows the economy about a year to try to rebound and bounce back a little bit. However, the situation is the whole revenue generation model is very antiquated, and I think what you're seeing is that there's a general agreement over at the Capitol that there's a system here that needs to be fixed. It just remains to be seen what kind of agreement they can be reached about fixing it in general.
Laurie Levy of California's Employment Development Department. Laurie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Insight. Some fish in a vital California drinking water supply are stunted and deformed. Why is this happening, and what possible consequence could it have for non-fish consumers of San Francisco estuary water? UC Davis biologist David Ostrak has studied this problem, and he joins us. He's in our studio. David Ostrak, welcome to Insight.
Jeffrey, thank you very much for inviting me back to your program.
Tell us more about the condition of these striped bass that you've been looking at in the San Francisco estuary. How do they look?
Well, it depends. In the study that generated the press release, we're looking at the effects on larval fish or baby fish that prior to their beginning to eat food. So it's they're relying on energy sources from their mother that they've gotten from their eggs. And what we found is various classes of contaminants in the eggs are being passed on to the baby fish and causing problems with development and growth.
What exactly is wrong with them?
Well, they're hatching out in the shape of the fish is wrong, and they're longer and thinner than they should be at hatch. We looked at these larval fish in a new way. Rather than using linear measurements, we looked at the volume of the whole fish as well as the volume of developing organs and the condition of the organs. And what we found was that the brain growth was retarded in these fish, that liver growth was accelerated during early development and then retarded right before they needed to go out and search for food. The yolk, which is their energy store, is also depleted by the time they need to go out and look for food. So you have a young fish whose liver is dysfunctional and has no energy stores to go out and search for food just at the time they critically need it.
Those sound like serious problems.
Yes, they are. The vast majority of the larvae of these fish would probably never make it to first feeding or not make it much further beyond that.
We're talking about serious problems that have been found in some striped bass in the San Francisco estuary. My guest is a UC Davis biologist, David Ostrak. He's research scientist at the Center for Watershed Sciences, and he's been studying these fish in this area for many years. The San Francisco estuary, just for my sake as well as others, what is the San Francisco estuary as opposed to the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta?
Well, essentially, it encompasses the delta. They're sort of interchangeable. It depends on how you look at it. The San Francisco Bay estuary system includes the North and South Bay, San Pablo Bay, up through what people typically call the delta.
Where did you take these striped bass that you tested? Where were they from?
Well, what happens with striped bass is similar to salmon. The adult striped bass exploit most of the estuary throughout the year, and some even go out to the ocean for a couple months during the summertime. But then they need to run up the rivers. They need to travel up the rivers like the salmon to spawn in the springtime. And so that's when we capture the adult male and female striped basses on their spawning runs, and we captured these ones on the upper Sacramento River.
Why should we care about striped bass?
Well, striped bass are what's called an apex or top of the food web predator. And in aquatic and terrestrial systems, when there's problems with an apex predator, there are problems below in the ecosystem. And striped bass and apex predators have been shown to be very good sentinels of ecosystem health.
Meaning when you say they're at the apex, the top of the food web, that means that they are big predators, and so they're eating something a bit smaller, which has in turn eaten something a bit smaller. And so whatever's in the water is going to surely make its way to the striped bass.
Right. Both what's in the water, they can, what's called bioaccumulate, or these compounds build up in their tissues from water passed across their gills, as well as food sources that they're eating. And so these contaminants are then magnified as the fish continues to grow. The specific contaminants in this study are what are called lipophilic or fat-soluble compounds. And the relevance here is that the female striped bass uses almost all of her fat every year to produce her eggs. So that what we see in the eggs is reflective of what that fish has seen in the water and in her food supply during the previous year.
I see. So the striped bass is a useful and an appropriate species for this kind of study?
Yes, it's an extremely useful species, even though it's an introduced resident that's been here since the late 1880s. It and salmon and the other pelagic fish, the fish that use the water column, have coexisted and thrived for almost 100 years until the first decline started in the 70s and then later in the 80s and the 90s.
You found serious problems in baby striped bass fish. How common were these problems in the fish that you found? Were these just sort of a few fish affected, or was it common?
No, all of the fish that we have captured from the Sacramento River spawning run, whether they're a smaller female of 5 or 10 pounds or a larger one of 40 or 50, have similar contaminant levels in their eggs. Some of our recent work, the past 3 years, my laboratory is part of the pelagic organism decline work team that's investigating the collapse of several of these fish species. We've now found that there are a few subgroups that live in other areas, perhaps up in the upper rivers where they never see the estuary, where some of their eggs are cleaner. But historically, the Sacramento River run it produces the vast majority, over 75% of the striped bass population, and every single female that we've captured has these levels of contaminants and these effects in their eggs.
These baby striped bass with these serious problems, how many of them are likely to live to adulthood?
Well, in the case of the way the striped bass spawns, they broadcast hundreds of thousands of eggs that turn into larval fish. In a very healthy situation, very few make it to the next juvenile stage and then on to the adults. In this case, the estimates from our 2006 study that we repeated at UC Davis of this earlier 1999 and 2001 study indicate that about 95% of the larvae from these contaminated eggs would never make it to first feeding. So you're wiping out, 90 to 95% right off the bat, which is not particularly good. And then we've also found serious effects in the juvenile fish throughout the summer that have survived.
How big a drop has there been in the striped bass population in the San Francisco estuary?
It depends on which portion of the population you're looking at. One of the main indicators is what's called the Young of the Year Index, or the 38-millimeter index at the end of the summer. And that index has dropped dramatically over the past decades, and in particular the past 10 years is close to the x-axis, near zero, in single-digit numbers, where typically it was, anything less than 100 was pretty drastic.
David Ostrak is a research scientist at the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences. He's found very serious problems in baby striped bass in the San Francisco estuary. I read that these fish have been contaminated before birth with a toxic mix of pesticides, industrial chemicals, and flame retardants. Well, I can understand the pesticides, the runoff from the fields, but where do the flame retardants come from?
Well, the flame retardants, or the PBDEs, are a new class of compounds under investigation that have now they're in the environment as ubiquitous as the PCBs. They're used in paint, they're used in upholstery, they're used in carpeting, and that's also likely due to runoff and industrial production of these compounds as well.
The San Francisco estuary is the source of drinking water for most Californians and also for most of the state's farms. Should we, non-fish consumers of the water, be concerned?
Well, again, that's not my direct area of expertise. However, I mean, it is concerning because one of the things about striped bass is they utilize their whole ecosystem similar to human beings. We go where the food is, we exploit the whole area. And some of these compounds, and in particular these flame retardants, have been found to be bioaccumulating in human beings at relatively high levels that have been shown to cause problems in other mammals, such as rats and mice, which are used as the test species for humans.
I'm guessing that flame retardants, industrial chemicals and the like in the San Francisco estuary water that's bad for the striped bass is also bad for the other fish.
Yes. Yes, it is. Essentially, like I said, these compounds we're finding in the eggs are reflective of the last year of this fish's life, what it's found in 1 year. So other fish that are living in the same water and eating the same food sources are being exposed to the same levels of contaminants and accumulating them perhaps at the same kinds of rates with similar outcomes.
Many of us have heard about the ecological crash in the Delta. Is this an example of that?
Well, again, I want to caution. There's no one smoking gun here. Contaminants were largely overlooked in the past due to the effects of hydrodynamics and pumping and water management, which is also a big problem. What we have here in the Delta is what's called a multiple stressor situation. We have many bad things going on. We have the hydrodynamics from the pumps. We have introduced invasive clam species. We have introduced zooplanctons from Asia that have replaced our local species, which are the food for the larval fish. We have toxic algal blooms. We have potential other food web and other contaminant problems. And so what it is we have all of these various problems that are occurring. And in my opinion, over the past couple of decades, these stressors have increased one by one and gotten worse. And if you use an analogy that's used for climate change a lot, the canoe analogy, if you think of the estuary as a canoe and you keep adding these stressors as cargo, at some point the canoe begins to take on water and eventually will sink.
If you were to talk with regulators in California, what do you think needs to be done based on your particular research in the San Francisco estuary?
Well, I think, I mean, the regulators are somewhat involved in this. The management who has funded our work the last few years is doing their best to try and address some of these concerns. I think from the area of contaminants versus some of these other stressors, this is something that we can do something about. Some of the legacy compounds that are there are pretty difficult to clean up, but measures can be taken. And more importantly, the compounds like PBDEs, the flame retardants, that are still highly unregulated, there could be regulations. And we need to look at the pollutants that are being put into the system and try and stop making the mistakes that we've made in the past, as well as hopefully dealing with water treatment in such a way that it can take care of some of these contaminant issues before it ever makes it out to the Delta.
And finally, David, you've been studying fish in the Delta and the estuary for about 20 years. What's the trend that you've observed?
Well, the trend is a pretty disturbing trend. The other three species in the pelagic organism decline, the Delta smelt, threadfin shad, and longfin smelt, have all seriously declined. The size of striped bass has decreased over time. In other words, a fish of a certain age is now smaller. It's basically a disturbing trend, not only in the fish, but in pretty much every portion of the food web, we've had problems from primary productivity all the way up. It's a very disturbing trend.
David Ostrak, UC Davis biologist. He's a research scientist at the Center for Watershed Sciences. We recently read about and now just heard about the work that he and his colleagues have been doing, studying serious problems found with striped bass in the San Francisco estuary. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you inviting me back again, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the state of flamenco as organizers prepare for a big performance event this week in Sacramento. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did something on Insight particularly please you? Email us and tell us what it was and why you liked it so much at insight@capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, the latest local housing sales numbers, plus an important vote coming up at the California Air Resources Board that would aim to reduce diesel exhaust emissions from trucks. Those stories and more are later today on All Things Considered. When you think of Spain, chances are flamenco comes quickly to mind. It's a style of music and dance that's passionate, flamboyant, and distinctive. But flamenco's so-called golden age has come and gone. Keeping the flame alive in our area is a group called Sacramento Arte Flamenco. This Thursday night, they're putting on a big flamenco performance event. We've got several people who are performing in this event in our studio. We'll start with Melinda Johnson, who's founder and director of Sacramento Arte Flamenco. Melinda, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
You gasped when I said that the golden age had come and gone, but in an email we got from you, I believe, you said that this, or someone said, it's in danger of dying out globally.
You know, some of the old palos, the older forms, are in danger of dying out. They aren't practicing them. Younger students are not studying with the old masters. They're studying with newer people. And some of the older forms are dying out.
Okay, and we'll talk.
The wonderful thing about working with Flamenco Puro, Andrea Paco, our instructor, is that it's flamenco in its pure form. And it's really very enjoyable to learn. She's excellent.
We'll talk about more a little bit later, but first, how hard a dance to learn is flamenco?
It's extremely difficult. I'm at the beginning of my fifth year, and I take lessons at least twice a week, and I am just barely beginning to feel competent.
Wow.
The footwork is extremely complex, and there are many, many different rhythms. Each rhythm has a different number of beats to it, and they're called palos, the rhythms, and each palo has accents in different places. So you have to memorize those. You have to learn to dance to them. And fortunately, we have a great teacher.
We're talking about flamenco. Melinda Johnson is founder and director of Sacramento Arte Flamenco, which is putting on a big flamenco performance event this Thursday evening in Sacramento at the 24th Street Theater. Melinda referred a couple of times there to Drea Paco, who is director of the group Flamenco Puro. She's also a soloist performing in this Thursday's event. Drea, welcome to Insight.
Hi.
Tell us more about flamenco. What makes it so challenging?
One of the most challenging things I found out about flamenco coming from a long ballet and modern dance background is that you are an instrument. You are not dancing to music. The musicians are dancing to you, and there's a trade-off of improvisation. So you have to learn a lot about the cante or the singing. You have to learn the structures of guitar progressions to dance with them. You need to use your ears for the hand clapping or the palmas. And you have to lead with your feet, with percussion. You have to change rhythms. You have to accent. And it's a long journey, and it never ends.
How many people are involved in a typical flamenco performance, dancers, musicians?
A typical performance, I would consider that a cuadro, and that's four people. That's the dancer, the singer, the guitarist, and the palmero, which is the clapping.
So those are the palmero. The clapping is a distinct element. There's a separate person doing that.
Usually it's another dancer now. A long time ago in Spain, probably, it was that somebody had that specific job. But now it's we multitask now.
The dancer can be a man or a woman, correct?
Correct.
And is it typically more one than the other?
It's typically more female because women are more attracted to dance in general. So women in general outnumber men in flamenco.
Does the dancer in flamenco have a persona like you find in some dances? Are they representing something else, or are they being a dancer who's dancing?
In flamenco, we celebrate the individual spirit. So once you learn how to dance flamenco, you learn the rhythms, your inner spirit comes out. So I've seen men that dance very feminine. I've seen women that dance very masculine. I've seen them combined. It just depends on that person's style.
How long have you been dancing flamenco?
I think over 15 years. I've stopped counting. I don't want to count it anymore.
Whereas Melinda, you said you've been doing it for 5 years.
Yes.
What brought you into it?
Well, it's actually kind of an interesting story. I developed osteoporosis young, in my 40s, and I broke my hip. It took 2.5 years to recover from that. I had to retire from my career as an art instructor. And as soon as I could walk again, I loved dance my whole life. I also have a background in ballet. And I saw a poster for flamenco classes with Drea's picture on it, and I just grabbed it off the wall, and I went, I'm going to do this. And I went, and I was hooked from the very first day.
There's a big flamenco performance event in Sacramento this Thursday evening. We're talking about that and flamenco, the dance especially, in our studio. Also with us, along with Melinda Johnson and Drea Paco, are two young dancers. Let me see if I can pronounce this correctly. Aprendiza? Is that correct?
Yes.
Aprendiza. Is that apprentice?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Well, you're Leah Horner, correct?
Yes.
And you are Rose Vermaisen?
Yes.
Now, you are both aprendizas, which means you're apprentice flamenco dancers. Are you going to be dancing on Thursday night?
Yes, we are. We will be doing two sevillanas, and we get to dance together for both of those, so we're really excited about that.
Leah, what does it mean to be an apprentice flamenco dancer?
We take classes every Wednesday night, and we're pretty much training to become flamenco dancers. Well, we're not entirely sure about that though.
Melinda Johnson wrote us an art grant,
yes,
along with Drea Picotte. And that allows us to have rehearsal time and a class every Wednesday until, of course, tomorrow. And then tomorrow we are performing Nueva Edad, tomorrow, December 11th at 7:30 p.m.
Very good. You just did my job for me.
Oh.
I'm just pulling your leg. Rose, how did you get into flamenco? What interested you about flamenco?
We started during the summer. We had a summer intensive since we're ballet dancers. So Drea came and taught us something. And they wanted to use some apprentices in their show tomorrow. And about 3 months ago, we started taking classes. And we've loved it ever since. So.
Leah, what's the difference between dancing flamenco and dancing ballet?
Well, as Drea said, you are the instrument. And in flamenco, it's okay if you mess up. It's okay if you're doing something different from your partner. It's really lively. In ballet, you have to be with the music. And if you're dancing a group dance, you have to usually do what everyone else is doing, unless it's choreographed differently.
Well, you two have serious dance training from ballet. How does flamenco compare? Is it easier or harder or just so different that you can't even compare them, learning ballet, learning flamenco?
It's much different, so it's hard to compare the two.
Okay. Drea, how helpful is a ballet training for a flamenco dancer, or is it really beside the point?
For me, it's helpful when I'm teaching Leah and Rose in that they learn really quickly. They can memorize movement really fast, and they can take corrections really fast as well.
I see.
So if I give them a correction, it's corrected immediately.
Oh, my goodness. That's a good thing.
And that's fun for a teacher.
Both girls are in one or two ballet companies. They're in the Sacramento Ballet, correct, Rose? Yes, and also the Crockett Dean Ballet for Rose and Leah, and I believe one or both have apprenticed with the San Francisco Ballet.
Oh, my goodness. So you two are big time.
They are.
Yes.
They're spectacular.
Tell us how long the dance you're doing tomorrow night is, Rose? Roughly.
Roughly. I think it's going to be 3 minutes long for
my
our
goodness.
Dance.
And you're dancing together, correct?
Yes.
Is that a lot to learn, Leah?
Well, we have such a wonderful teacher, and we've been taking classes so long that we have it down pretty well.
No.
I'm confident we're going to have fun and do well.
Have you tried other kinds of dance in addition to ballet and flamenco?
Yes.
Yeah. I've done tap, and that's about it, other than a few classes scattered.
And Rose?
I've done contemporary, modern, jazz, tap, ballet, and flamenco.
Oh,
but
goodness.
All of them were pretty much during a summer intensive. None of them I really stuck to except flamenco and ballet.
Drea Paco, tell us how you got into flamenco and what kind of dance you did before that.
I did modern dance before that. I was really heavily involved in it at UC Davis, and I was going to get my master's until my mother, who is also in the show, introduced me to flamenco. And at first I didn't really resonate with it until I saw Maria Benitez's company come through UC Davis, and then that was it, and that was in my early 20s.
The performance event, the Evening of Flamenco, is called Nueva Edad?
Yes.
More or less correct?
Yes.
What does that mean? Obviously new.
New age. It's a new age.
And what does that mean in this context?
This is the first production that Sacramento Arte Flamenco has put on. And it's just a new time for all of us. We've had to all kind of shift our hats and work cooperatively together and collaborate. It's really working out well, too.
Drea.
It's fabulous.
Drea, where does flamenco come from? Spain, is that correct?
Yes, I can give you a brief history. I don't study the history a lot, unfortunately. But if you think of the gypsies traveling from India down to southern Spain and then on their journey playing music the whole time, changing the music until they end up in southern Spain, that's kind of a picture. And then the history of the gypsies in Spain, they were persecuted and they've had a lot of suffering. And it is born out of the cante, out of the song. That's what we call cante hondo. It's more a deeper song. It reflects a lot of pain and agony. And then through that, the guitar emerged, and then the dance after.
There are a lot of Spanish speakers in the American continent. Did they bring flamenco with them? Is there a Latin American type of flamenco, or has flamenco stayed rooted in its Spanish origins?
I think it's pretty much stayed rooted in the Spanish origins. However, it starts to change through the artistic license of the artists themselves, because flamenco is a growing art form. There's a lot of fusion, flamenco fusion happening now.
Yes.
In fact, we have Cerro Negro performing with us, and they are a jazz flamenco fusion group.
Okay.
And they're great.
Rose Vermeizen and Leah Horner, just the last question for you two. How do you feel when you're dancing flamenco? And compare that to how you feel when you're dancing ballet. Leah?
Well, when I do ballet, I feel really graceful and like I could touch the sky because you have to really lengthen. And in flamenco, it's a very romantic dance, as we've been told. And since we're so young, we don't really get that part. I really get into it, and it's much more fierce.
And Rose?
I think flamenco is a very lively dance, and I like the rhythm to it, and it really makes me come alive, and I like it a lot.
And Melinda, how do you feel when you're doing flamenco? You picked it up just 5 years ago?
I just feel so free. I love it. I love it every time I get something, you know, and can do it. I just love it. I want to do it over and over and over. I mean, I really, truly believe it's slightly addicting.
I can imagine. Well, Sacramento Arte Flamenco presents Nueva Edad, which is an evening of flamenco. It's this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the 24th Street Theater. On the bill, Drea Paco, who's director of Flamenco Puro, one of the groups involved. She's a soloist. She's a teacher of flamenco. Rose Vermeizen and Leah Horner are aprendizas or apprentice flamenco dancers. And Melinda Johnson is the founder and director of Sacramento Arte Flamenco. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Gracias.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on our show, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producer was the hardworking Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Directing the program was John Bernaysi. Insight's senior producer, and hopefully getting better, is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Earthquake is scheduled to destroy a bridge in Reno, but don't worry, it's a simulated earthquake and a scale-sized bridge. On the next Insight, you'll hear what researchers hope to learn from this. Also, Around the World in 30 Blocks, we start a tour of restaurants on Sacramento's Broadway. Plus, the Latin and klezmer-influenced jazz of Anat Cohen. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.